Accession number 28354, Reel 7.
You said you got the most colossal blast from Captain D.
Very nice man he was, actually. But he quite rightly tore me up into the strip. He didn't know my wife was actually down Sheerness, so he had to accept my excuse that I said I came down, went on to Harwich, because I knew that the ship was due to do some gunnery exercises, which it was, the next day and the day after, and that I'd come down in order to do them. And he, with a bit of disbelief in his eyes, he accepted this. And the surprise on his face when we met in the bar of the Fountains Hotel at lunchtime, I with my wife, he'd just come in to have a drink. C.R.L. Parry, his name was. He accepted it. I remember he used to snort. He was a great snorter as he talked. And that drink at the bar got several snorts, but he didn't say anything. And I had my 4 days in Sheerness with my wife. I must say, looking back, this episode always surprises me. But I suppose I could have been court-martialed for disobeying the Commander-in-Chief's orders or whatever. Anyway, I got away with it.
Now, I just want to have a very short break here because you mentioned your wife, but in this story we've had nothing of how you might have met and a courtship and so on, and suddenly a wife has appeared. Could you tell me a little about that?
Yes, I'm half Maltese, and I met my wife in Malta when I was a midshipman in HMS Revenge. That was the first time I met her. And I always liked this girl very much. She was 3 years older than me, and at that time I wasn't thinking of marriage or anything of that sort. And anyway, she then married a chap called Stephen Hebblethwaite, an observer in the Fleet Heron, an extremely nice man. She chose well. And he sadly was killed when HMS Glorious was sunk after the Norwegian campaign. My wife, having followed him to Alexandria, where I, again, used to go and see them, I often went to see that couple in their house or flat in Alexandria, she'd come back to Malta, by then with a daughter. Louise was born in February 1940, and he then sent her a telegram saying, "Come, go to England." Glorious was then sent home from the Mediterranean. And she got on actually the last P&O to leave Malta before Italy came into the war, the Narcunda. And she came back in that ship to England, arrived in Southampton with this small baby, and was met by her sister-in-law. In fact, the only person in England she knew. And went and stayed with her in Southampton. This woman worked in Tyrrell and Green, the shop in Southampton. And 7 days later, she opened her paper and saw that Glorious had been sunk, and she was a widow. She went on living with this lady. They were then completely bombed out in Southampton, and had to move. And they went to a house in Longstock, to a farmhouse in Longstock, where the owners obviously were decided the best thing was to take on somebody like my wife and her sister-in-law, rather than have some refugees or whatever imposed on them. And so they lived there for quite a while. Meanwhile, I'd left HMS Offa and was down doing courses in Portsmouth, ready to take up my command. And I went to Longstock. My conscience struck me that I knew there was this girl had been widowed, and I'd known her and had not done anything about it. And I went to see her in Longstock. I think I've got to go back. I'm getting my thing muddled up. In HMS Witherington, I forgot to finish the story of Witherington. I think I said that I left her in Hull. Absolutely incorrect. We steamed, mended Witherington and took her out of the dock, came round to Portsmouth on our way to Plymouth to do some more gunnery with the same commander-in-chief who was going to throw us out if it wasn't good. And we went alongside in Portsmouth on the way to Plymouth. We were just ahead of HMS Revenge at South Railway Jetty. And that was the night of the huge bombing raid on Portsmouth. There was one when the power station was hit and when it went on all night. And we were lying alongside this jetty. And late in the bombardment, I realized the Germans had changed their tactics. They were no longer bombing the town. They were actually running along the line of the jetty, where the jetty and the water was. Presumably, that was clearly the line they were running. And I said, they're going to hit somebody soon, and it'd probably be us. And I told my captain, I got the engineer officer to raise steam, and then told my captain, we're ready to go to sea, why don't we leave? And he, I'm afraid, dithered. He was a great ditherer, that one. And he rang up the duty staff officer, who not unreasonably said, if you go to sea and they mine the entrance and you sink there, that'll be worse than if you're hit alongside. Certain amount of logic in this, but I just wanted to go out into the stream, because clearly we were in the danger zone. And sure enough, about 2 a.m, I can't remember when it was, we were hit by 3 bombs. We were awfully lucky, because they all went straight through the ship. They just penetrated, they were obviously armour-piercing, and we had no armour in that destroyer. And they went straight through the ship, but one at least exploded underneath it, underneath the boiler room. It went through the boiler room and spread it underneath.
In the water underneath?
Yeah, in the mud, presumably, underneath us, yes. In the water underneath us, yes. It didn't explode in the ship, it exploded underneath the ship, having penetrated right through the deck, the boiler room. It didn't hit a boiler. It went, curious enough, it went through the only space that there isn't a boiler. I never thought of that. It was quite a small space where the Stoker Petty officer used to stand. Indeed, it went right by him and out through the bottom, and then it went pop. And the ship leapt up in the air and whiplashed like mad, and she broke her back too. I don't think she ever sailed again. My advice was the right advice. The captain, unfortunately, didn't take it. The engineer officer and a wonderful mechanician Stubbs, went round all the compartments in the ship. They were responsible for shutting off valves and closing doors and everything, keep the ship afloat. And I went round doing the same on the upper levels, with the captain going round the other side of the bridge telling everybody to abandon ship. I said he couldn't make decisions. This was the one time he made a decision, it was the wrong one. And I dodged him all the way, and we didn't abandon ship, and we kept the ship afloat just. I don't think it was any value, actually. And then we offloaded ourselves and went and spent the night in HMS Revenge just astern of us. Curious enough, in the morning our ship had gone, because what we hadn't realised is that most of the wires holding it to the jetty had been severed, and she quietly, still afloat, drifted out into the middle of the channel. There she was, still afloat, a sort of ruin with nobody on board next morning. But it was then that I, in the interregnum, after that ship was hit, and my going to HMS Offa, that I went to see my wife-to-be at Longstock. And then I went away in Offa. And it wasn't until I came back to Amos Smith's in Hull and left that ship, and then contacted her again, that the romance started. She was then living in Hatfield. They'd moved from Southampton and were living on the in the Hatfield Park on the Earl of Salisbury's, Marcus of Salisbury's place, in a gardener's cottage. And she was with a cousin of hers whose husband was at sea, and the two of them were sharing this cottage. And I went to see them there, I suppose. And then we got engaged. We got engaged after I'd... We got engaged when I went to do a course, anti-submarine course in Liverpool, because I've always been ashamed. I did it by letter on the way to that course. instead of going on bended knee. And we got married while I'd taken over Commander Cottesmore in February or whenever, 1943, and we were married in London in June, '43. Yeah, in the Brompton Oratory. She was still then living in this house in Hatfield. It had no gas and no electricity, so they cooked on a horrible black stove and lots of primacy stove things. And part of my ploy for marrying this girl was that I would provide her with electricity. Took me a hell of a long time to do it, actually. I eventually did. Mm-hmm. Right, where were we? Taking over Cottesmore.
You've taken over the Cottesmore. Thank you very much for that digression. Not really a digression at all, an important part of the story. But you've taken over Cottesmore in January 43.
Yeah.
I just
got to sea for the first time. Yes. Well, I talked about the convoys a bit, didn't I?
Yes.
As I said, there was no great event on any of those convoys. There were air attacks, but nothing very spectacular. One very remarkable thing I discovered in that ship. I'd noticed before that when I'd been officer of the watch, particularly with Alistair Ewing in offer, and for no reason at all, the captain appeared on the bridge, and he'd say, "What's that ship doing there?" And I'd never seen it. And somehow he, some sense, had told him it was to come. He should come up and have a look, and he did. And he shamed one because there was something you just hadn't seen or hadn't done. It was, you know, those sort of things. And I discovered when I became a captain that exact thing happened to me, in exactly the same way. The best example of it was we were coming down the east coast, coming south, ahead of a convoy. It was absolutely still, flat night with bright moonlight. There wasn't the likelihood of an E-boat. You'd have seen it at 20 miles, so to speak, if there had been one. So I'd gone to my bunk. I was still dressed, but I turned in. And I woke up feeling desperately uneasy. And no idea why, but couldn't stay in my bunk, so I went up on the bridge. And just ahead of us was a wreck boy, flashing, which wreck boys do, obviously. And it was just on the starboard bow. Or was it? Which bow? Doesn't matter anyway. And I said to the officer watch, who was a Lieutenant Putnam, Royal Naval Reserve, I said, "What's that wreck boy flashing?" And he said, "Two, sir. Flashing two every minute." And I said, "No, it's not. It's three." And the blood drained out of this boy's face, I remember, completely. And I rushed to the side of the bridge and looked over just as we passed between the wreck boy and the wreck, and I could see the wreck in the still water with the tide flowing over it. You could clearly see the ship there, and we actually passed between the boy and the wreck. He was going the wrong side of the boy, but why had I woken up? It's all puzzled me. Amazing. I did wake up, but I didn't wake up quick enough. But that was a lucky break, and that happened several times in similar. You know, you had an idea there was something wrong and you went up. Something that happens. What other episodes were there in that? I actually ran Cottesmore aground my first week. I went into Harwich after my first patrols, after taking to sea, went into Harwich to fuel and spend the day in Harwich, and was turning the ship in order to go alongside a tanker. And we went into the lovely soft putty. It was all right. Soft and squidgy. And nobody knew. And we came off and went alongside the tanker. But I think I should go on, really, to when... to 1940... 40... Well, I suppose I should tell the story of my wedding.
Yes, please do.
Well, no, the only bit of the story of the wedding worth telling is that I stayed in a club, in the Lansdowne Club in Berkeley Square, very good address, serving officers without it on the tree from water, and my wife was staying with friends in a flat in Park Lane somewhere. And in the morning, I got up, dressed in my uniform, ready to marry this girl, and picked up all the accoutrements, and I couldn't find the wedding ring. And I rang her up and I said, "Darling, the worst has occurred." Now, I was 43, lots of talk. She thought, "Oh God, the second front has opened, and he's off somewhere." And I said, "No, not that. I've lost the ring." Well, luckily she was a widow, so I said, "When you get to the church, my brother was my best man, give your old ring to my brother, and he can then take it in, and I'll marry you with that one." So we did, we married with the old ring, and then went back to afterwards, after the reception, to the Lansdowne Club, where I changed into plain clothes in order to go off on our honeymoon, and as I picked a handkerchief off the top of a chest of drawers, like this, and I saw something gold flying through the air. There was the ring. It turned up again.
Were wartime honeymoons straightened affairs or not?
Well, the great thing in wartime was, when is the next boiler clean? Because that was the only leave you got, when the ship had to come in and clean her boilers. So the more time you were at sea, steaming on, we only had two boilers, steaming on two boilers, the better, really. When you were in harbour, you only had one on, so you're using up less boiler hours. So the more sea time you did, the sooner came that bit of leave. And so life, married life or love life or whatever, revolved around boiler cleans. So we had 4 days, four days or five days, something, I guess. Came in on the Sunday, we were married on the Monday, and back on the Friday, that's right. So, and that's another bit of story, because we went on the honeymoon in to Gloucestershire somewhere, and came back, and I hadn't been very clever over all this. I hadn't booked anywhere to stay in London for the night. I thought it would be easy, and I started ringing up hotels. Every single hotel, absolutely full, nothing at all. And I finally rang the Ritz, and they had a bed. And we stayed that night in the Ritz. That was lovely, very comfortable. The only time I've ever been in the Ritz in my life. I shamed myself next morning, because I thought, you'll never get a taxi in London in wartime, so I better get up nice and early to catch the taxi to get back to Chatham to take the ship out to sea again. And walked out of the Ritz Hotel on the side entrance there, not on the Piccadilly entrance, and walked straight into a cab, and I caught a train at Victoria 1 hour earlier than the one I'd set out to catch. That's a fairly shameful thing to do on your honeymoon, I think. And as I walked on board, the first attendant said, "You're very early, sir." The great thing of that ship was that we were at Normandy at D-Day, for that we went down to Portsmouth some time before. There were three ships from our flotilla, Peitchley, Cattistock, and my ship Cottesmore, in the close support of the invasion, and. Obviously, we went to Portsmouth and did a lot of practices at, what's the beach? The beach down in Dorset. Studland. In Studland Bay. That was we were Force G, the Gold Beach, and that was where Force G did its practicing. And we practiced the run-in and pseudo-bombardment and landing of troops, etc., there, time and time and time again. And then went back and anchored us in the Solent with all this mass of ships. It's a most extraordinary sight, seeing so many ships. With curiosity, actually, one thing we've been doing a lot of Channel convoys rather than East Coast convoys in the build-up to D-Day. And as you did those convoys, you passed Dungeness Beach and other beaches on the way, in which were these enormous great concrete blocks being built. We passed them and wondered, and we never guessed what they were. These, of course, were the Mulberry Harbour. I suppose since we never guessed, nobody else did. They were there in such full view. Anyway, we... of course, there was a 24-hour delay, and then we sailed for the beachhead with Force G. We actually didn't sail with the Force G. We sailed with the minesweepers. We went over as Peichley, the other, my senior officer, actually, and myself, escorted the minesweepers sweeping the swept channel to Gold Beach, and they swept, and we toddled along behind them. And we got off the beachhead, I suppose, at 1 o'clock in the morning, something like that, very, quite early. And nothing happened, absolutely nothing. Nothing was happening. It may have been a little bit later than that, but it doesn't matter. And there were all the RAF going over doing their bombing, but nothing happening ashore at all. And we unmolested in any way. To the extent that at 3 o'clock in the morning we both anchored. The last thing I expected was to sit off an enemy beach at anchor for a couple of hours waiting for the dawn to come, and we just sat quietly at anchor. This, of course, shows the efficacy of the radar jamming. Every ship had jammers, which one knew nothing about. You were just told to switch them on at a certain time. We had no idea what frequencies or what they were doing at all. So there were these arrays of jammers, and presumably the German radar was completely swamped and made totally negative as a result. Hence the quietness. Then as dawn broke, we weighed anchor and got into position, and then the armada of landing craft and ships and bombardment vessels and everything came sweeping in. And
this, if I could just interrupt for 1 second, this might be almost a good point at which to stop, because we're nearly at the end of this.
That's fine.
We're about 5 minutes away. And then we can continue next time with the D-Day landings.
Fine, yep.
I just want to perhaps if we could end today with this question, and that is, was there any sense of trepidation on the part of you, your officers, the crew, as to what you were taking part in?
Oh, yes. It's hard to remember it now. I can remember it in retrospect, so to speak, in that I have never felt so utterly drained as I was that night. I was finished completely. And I suppose mostly emotional and fear, and I presume, anyway, trepidation, yes, it was there. I don't know whether one was very conscious of it in anticipation. It was worrying. It was worrying that you were doing it in such rough weather. How on earth were these soldiers going, who were obviously there, you could see them coming along, they were sick as dogs, some of them. In the landing craft, how on earth were they going to do it in that weather, and how were they going to beach? I think that was not concerned for ourselves so much, actually, as for the operation, for them, yes.
Well, I think that's a good point upon which we might conclude. And we'll pick up the story again with the D-Day landings.
Yeah, we better fix a date.
Well, when we next meet. Sir William, thank you very much indeed for continuing with your contribution to the Sound Archive of the Imperial War Museum. It's much appreciated. I think we left it last time that you were sailing towards Gold Beach. And you were sailing with the minesweepers, and that is, I think, where we got to. If you could pick up the story.
Yes, I was in company with HMS Peichley, and we went down the swept channel, the stern of the minesweepers. across to the area off the beach where the minesweeper swept the assault area for the ships and vessels and landing craft that were following behind us. And we just hung around, and to our surprise, nothing happened. Lots of aeroplanes going across and bombardments ashore, but where we were, absolute quiet. And that caused us great surprise. And so we continued quiet, so at about 3 a.m. we anchored and had a sort of grandstand view of the bombing ashore and had nothing to do. And then, I think I've already said all this, we weighed anchor at, I suppose it must have been about early in the morning, 5 o'clock something, I guess, because I think the assault went in at 6 and got into position in the swept channel as all the mass of shipping came up behind us. And we were, these two small destroyers, Peitschley and Cottesmore, had in the middle with landing craft, lines of landing craft coming in either side of us, and we went in with them, with the, not making this very clear, our job was to bombard the beach initially, to break up the beach obstacles, and then in particular to break up the beach wall, which was at the back of the beach, which so that the tanks and vehicles could get through off the beach. And from the look of the beach wall afterwards, we went ashore a few days later, we didn't do too badly.
What size weapons, what type of guns were you using to break up?
Well, these are very small. In fact, on the run-in, we only had our forward 2 4-inch guns, which would bear. It was only when we got close in and stopped and could go broadside on that we could bring the other two into action. So not very heavy stuff. But mind you, there was lots of heavy stuff behind us, the cruisers and the battleships.
But they were firing right over.
They were firing right over, yes. Yeah.
Right. But they weren't actually bombarding the beach as well, or were they?
Yes, they were. Yes, they were. I couldn't tell you what targets they particularly had. But then there were, in the landing craft were these, there were landing craft rockets, which had batteries of rockets, which made the most fearsome sound and the most fearsome performance on the beach. It looked as though nothing would possibly exist afterwards, because lots of things did exist in Anglo-Saxon effective, I believe, as they looked. A pretty frightening sound. We didn't have a... How far off? We were about 3,000 yards off the shore, I suppose. That's a mile and a half. So you didn't have a very close view of the landings. And when the actual landing craft got to the beach, of course, we had to stop our bombardment and sat around waiting to be given opportunity targets as the Royal Artillery forward observation officers got ashore and called us in to bombard individual targets. We didn't get very many. I was rather disappointed. We fired rather less during that forenoon than I had expected. They got inshore quite quickly, presumably. And the bigger guns, I think, we use the bigger ships for these opportunity targets rather than us with our small 4-inch. Then we did chase an 88mm gun around for a while, which was causing trouble. It was enfilading the beach. Just stop a minute, will you? I'm going to take...
You were being chased by an 88?
Well, no, the 88mm gun, which was obviously a mobile, was enfilading the beach and causing a certain amount of trouble.
But you had to find it, of course.
Yes.
You couldn't see it.
This was quite interesting because in the orders for Operation Neptune, the Hunt-class destroyers were designated as expendable, which is a very nice thing to be told about your ship. It was in the orders as expendable, and that actually meant that you could do things which you otherwise wouldn't. And in fact, for this gun, I took the ship right in until I was aground, just aground. And we managed then to be able to see where he was firing from and actually fire at him and make him move away again. I think he probably started up again afterwards. But I used the excuse of being expendable to take the ship aground, which we wouldn't normally do. And we obviously got off. I mean, I only just touched the ground. And then.
And which way was the tide going?
The tide was still flooding, I'm glad to say, at that time. So again, you knew you had a certain amount of leeway.
Leeway, mm. Yes. And were you ever fired at? Did they?
Yes.
Or not?
This picture you you see above you there is just after we were fired at, and the reason the ship, the funnel of my ship is making a great puff of smoke is that I just put on a lot of revolutions to get away from the chap who was firing at us. It was a single gun, and it fired. I mean, we could see it coming towards us in the water, I mean, a splash, getting a few hundred yards closer every time he fired as he lifted the range up. And I went round in a 360 degree circle and firing at him when we got out of the way of him. And we think we stopped him because he didn't go on afterwards anyway. We did go ashore a few days later and went up to the battery, which we think was the one that was firing us, and certainly was the one we fired at. And to our great pleasure, one of the guns in that battery had a